It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out what goes into aging a 20-year cheddar and why it's selling for over $200 a pound.
First, the federal government issued a major call to action today to help bees and other major pollinators. The plan calls for help from everybody, government bureaus, farmers, landowners, and more.
Today's announcement follows last week's release of an annual survey of beekeepers showing a very substantial loss of bee colonies around the nation, with higher than average losses here in Wisconsin.
Keith Delaplane joins us now. He's a professor and director of the honeybee program at the University of Georgia. He's co-author of the Colony Loss 2014-2015 report from the Bee Informed Partnership. Keith, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, glad to be here.
So we'll get into the details of this federal announcement, but big picture, how much of a difference could it make for the nation's honeybees?
I think it's important because it sets an agenda and it makes a very loud statement at the national scale that we have a big problem here. It's mustering the resources and all of the rhetorical power of the federal government, and I think it's really getting people's attention, and that's a good first start.
And you've been watching this problem over the years. How big a problem? How worried should we be about our honeybees in this country?
Well, it certainly is a problem that has been there for quite a few decades, but what has really caught our attention was beginning in the winter of 2006 when our winter mortalities really took a nosedive, and that's when people started paying extra attention. And the situation has not really gotten better. I mean, it's been hovering around the 20 to 30% mortality mark every winter since.
And in this new report, it looks like it's not just winter. We did a little better this winter than the previous, but there were more summer die-offs of colonies.
Yes, and that was the big surprise. We've actually been collecting summer data now for our third year, and it's been surprising to see that they generally match our winter losses. It's very normal for honeybee losses to be high in winter, but finding this this trend for summer loss, that's troubling and unexpected.
So from what we know, what is causing these losses of honeybee colonies?
Well, I think most of your listeners have probably heard that there is a variety of issues playing into this. And part of the job of researchers is to try to untangle that knot and try to understand which factors are the most important in contributing most to this problem, and we're starting to get a better idea of that. And I think I'm along with most of my colleagues in saying that most honeybee colony deaths is due to parasitic varroa mites, environmental pesticides, and just poor quality forage out there in our habitats.
Now, in that survey we mentioned, it looks like some states had particularly bad losses of bee colonies. Here in Wisconsin, we're among the worst, not the very worst. Is this just statistical noise, or are there really regions where we're having bigger problems?
I do think that it's consistent that honeybee mortality tends to edge on the higher side in the upper Midwest. You know, up where you are, you generally do worse in, you know, Illinois, the Dakotas, Minnesota, than we do down here in the South. But probably the best explanation is just the gentler overwintering conditions. But there's plenty of parasitic pressure down here in the South as well that you think would compensate, but overall it seems to be worse up in the North Tier states.
We're talking to bee expert Keith Delaplane about recent numbers showing bad bee mortality rates in the country and a call today from the federal government to do more to help them. Now, let's get to some of the specifics of what the federal government is calling for, Keith. What are the key action items here as you see it?
What I like is that the federal government is asking all agencies to take a hard look at the federal lands that are under their control, and that's a sizable chunk of real estate. And if we were to make significant improvements in pollinator habitat just on federally owned lands, that would be a huge beneficial impact for our overall pollinator health and populations. They're looking at things like habitat restoration. How can we replace plants like lawn grass, for example, that have zero value for pollinators? Can we replace that with seed mixes that provide a continuous source of nectar all summer long? And that would just be a huge and measurable improvement to our pollinators of all species.
Well, that's federal land. Is the federal government looking for private landowners to join in this too?
They're certainly encouraging that. There will be incentives to promote federal and state and private cooperations on these matters. I predict that in our advertisements for grant proposals in the next year or two, we're going to see incentives for these types of partnerships. So, yes, an enthusiastic yes, and I think we'll see incentivization going on to make that happen.
Now, you mentioned these parasites. I know you've got a lot of them down south. We've got them up here. I imagine a hard winter plus parasites makes it harder for bees up in our neck of the woods. Is there anything we can do about these mites and other things that are part of the problem for bees?
The parasitic mite that everyone talks about is the varroa mite. And on the honeybee, the varroa mite is a non-natural parasite. It evolved on another species of bee from Southeast Asia. And what that means is our Western honeybee is very poorly equipped to deal with it. And we've had it since the 1980s, and we are still pretty much reliant on synthetic miticides that beekeepers lawfully put inside their hives to knock these mites back. But they never completely eliminate them. So it's been a very difficult problem to solve, and it fundamentally goes back to that evolutionary discontinuity between the two species.
Another cause people pointed to, and you alluded to it earlier, chemicals. People are worried about pesticides, including especially the ones called neonicotinoids. Still research going on. I think this new federal plan calls for more research. Do we know enough to start making decisions about what pesticides we should and shouldn't use when it comes to affecting bees?
Our knowledge is improving. EPA has been pushing for revised label language, which softens the impact of chemicals on pollinators. It's also reviewing some of the toxicity of these chemicals for their direct impacts on pollinators. And I predict in the near future we're going to be seeing some more modifications to our pesticide labels, advising users how to use them in manners that are less damaging to bees. One simple example, if you apply pesticides at night, then there's a good chance that they can do their job on the bad insects, but degrade to a level that's non-damaging by morning. We're going to see more and more changes to our instructions like that.
Briefly, what's at stake here if we can't turn this around for us humans?
It's no overstatement to say that the quality of life, the quality of diets that we enjoy in developed economies like ours can be laid at the feet of pollinators. Pollinators provide the diversity of food, the fruit parts of plants that we find very succulent and desirable. They're things like berries. They're things like forage crops that fuel our dairy industry, big up your way. And this is the kind of diets that you just don't have in very poor economies. So it's the diversity of our food. It's the price of our food. These are the things that are at stake.
Keith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Keith Delaplane, professor and director of the Honeybee Program at the University of Georgia, talking about today's announcement of federal action to boost the declining bee population. Wisconsin cheesemaker is pushing the envelope when it comes to aged cheddar. Hook's Cheese Company in Mineral Point made national news in 2009 when it released its first ever 15-year cheddar. Now, a 20-year aged cheese coming out at the end of the month. The price per pound high enough to make a buyer think twice. But when cheese enters the terrain usually reserved for, say, your fine wine, it's a moment for reflection here in a cheese-loving state.
Tony Hook, the owner and producer of Hook's Cheese Company, joins us now to talk about the cheese aging process and what goes into the making of a 20-year-old cheese. Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, your company,
for having me.
Your company has made a 15-year cheddar before. Now you're really going for it. You have a 20-year cheddar about to come out. What made you decide to do a 20-year?
15-year, the first year, was a very big hit. And the second year that we had the 15 available, we had a little more than we expected to sell. So I decided we'd put aside 11 of the 40-pound blocks and age them to 20 years. So we had about 450 pounds to age out, and that's going to debut next week.
Now, word is that some cheese stores are already sort of selling out. They've put it on the market for special order. Do you have a sense about how big a deal it is to have a 20-year-old cheddar?
Well, apparently it's a pretty big deal. We did plan on releasing it this year, June 1st, and we wanted to contact our stores and distributors that we deal with and just see what the market was for it. And We emailed and called people a couple months ago and put it out there. And for about the first week, we didn't hear back. We kind of wondered if we had the price a little high. And then a story went out about it, and it started selling, and we were sold out within about a month. So even before the cheese debuts, it's basically sold out.
I have to ask you, what is the price?
Retail, it's going for most places $209 a pound.
$209 a pound. But no one's going to buy a full pound of this, right, for their own personal family use. What would you buy, maybe a quarter pound or something?
Probably a quarter pound for most people. There are a few that are giving gifts that are maybe a half pound, even a few that are giving 1 pound. But most of them are 1/4 pound.
Now let's talk a little bit about the aging process for cheese. So this is 20 years you've had to nurture this cheese. What goes into that?
Well, whenever we make our cheddars, typically that's what we age the longest. We do make many other varieties, but the cheddars we age the longest, and we use the very same recipe on every batch, but of course every vat is a little different. It's got different milk, different time of the year, different humidity, temperatures, all that affect it. The feed affects it. So as we put it away to age, I'll test it a couple times a year to make sure that the cheese is developing like I want it to. So by the time it's, let's say, 2 to 3 years old, I pretty much know if it would be one that would age to 7, 8, 9, 10 years or beyond. It's just a matter of taste is what I go by. I can tell, you know, if there's any hint of anything off, it's time to sell that cheese. So as I test it a couple times a year going down the road, I can determine which ones should be sold right now, which ones I can age for quite a bit longer.
Where do you do the aging process?
We have a pretty fair-sized cold storage facility right attached to our cheese plant, and we can store about 550,000 pounds a year.
Wow. And what happens to a cheese as it ages? Because I know that sometimes it gets kind of like little crystals in it, and I've never been sure what those are as it gets older.
Sure. As cheddar ages, typically you would get, people say, sharper or a sharp cheddar. It'll get more acidic as it ages to about 3 to 5 years. You get the most acidic flavor. And after that, it starts smoothing out and starts forming calcium lactate crystals. So that's what the crystals are. The calcium and the lactose kind of form together and form a calcium lactate crystal. So it's almost got the consistency of a grain of salt, but it doesn't really have any flavor.
Is that crunchiness considered a desirable thing when you've got a really fine piece of aged cheddar, say?
Yes. When it is aged that long, it is something that you're expecting. You expect more of it as it ages. If it was in, say, just a one-year cheddar and they were judging it at a contest, they would consider that a defect. But by the time it gets to 5, 6, 7, 8 years, that's expected to be in there. That's going to develop. And the 20-year has got just a tremendous amount of those. The 15-year usually has quite a few, and the 20-year probably got double what the 15-year typically does.
This is maybe a weird question, but do you get attached to this cheese? You've been with it for 20 years, and you're about to send it off into the world.
Right, right. And my wife said, well, you saved us a little, didn't you? And I said, I think we're sold out. And actually, a week ago, somebody canceled a quarter-pound order, so she gets a quarter-pound. But, no, you know, we get to sample it all the way along, and yes, we know it's a good product, but that's what we make it for, is to send it out.
What does it taste like?
It's just like a very fine cheddar flavor with the calcium lactate crystals, so it's a lot of crunch.
All right. Well, Tony, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Tony Hook of Hook's Cheese Company. Up next is cheese expert Tanaya Darlington to talk about how to enjoy special occasion cheese. Welcome, Tanaya.
Thank you.
So we just talked about this new 20-year cheddar that's being released to the world soon. How rare is 20-year cheddar?
I've never heard of a 20-year cheddar, so I would say very, very rare. wondering if any of it will make it out to Philadelphia and the East Coast. I'm hoping.
Now, we heard that this cheddar is selling for $209 a pound, so this is obviously a special occasion cheese. You don't want to waste this maybe on a grilled cheese or something like that. So what is the right way to sort of do proper honors to a fine cheese like this?
You know, that's exactly the question I was asking, because it seems like you would want to eat it, like, alone in a closet without any sort of external stimulation, because you would just really want to taste the flavor. However, I was thinking a little bit about how this cheese would probably taste and what, you know, what are some things that you might want to notice or look for as somebody, you know, who might be in the lucky position of getting some. And I was imagining, okay, it's going to probably be really tangy, like maybe take the, you know, the skin off the roof of your mouth tangy. So you might want something kind of refreshing and effervescent afterwards. There are also going to be all these wonderful little tyrosine crystals, just like you find in aged Gouda or aged Parmesan. And, you know, so you'll have that, like, nice little crispy quality you might want to play off of. I know the Italians love to pair aged Parmesan with Prosecco. And I actually think that's a great idea for this cheese because, you know, obviously you're going to be celebrating or introducing it at some sort of celebratory occasion if you're trying it. And you want something that's going to cleanse your palate, which bubbles do. And I also think just the kind of sweet earthiness you find in a Prosecco would be a perfect complement to the flavors in this cheese. It's probably going to be fruity and nutty, really tangy with a little bit of earthy earthiness to it, maybe on the finish. So my suggestion would be, you know, eat it alone in the dark with a glass of
So nothing, you're not going to bother with like a cracker or a slice of baguette with this?
Oh, heavens no. Never a cracker. And baguette, if you want to like cleanse your palate between bites, because I think it will be a really intense experience. And I did think, you know, all right, this is a Wisconsin cheese. So if you wanted to play off terroir, maybe you should be having Wisconsin things. So if this were me and if I were still living in Madison, as I once did, I would go to the farmer's market. I would look for, okay, what's local and seasonal? Maybe some radishes. I remember loving Crest Springs bread, so like a rustic bread to kind of play off the high-class plowman's lunch that you might be, you know, enjoying. Maybe some fruit, maybe some nuts, something like a candied pecan could be really nice. Obviously not local or seasonal, but just kind of a nice flavor, something a little crunchy, something a little sweet. You could do some local charcuterie. Or if you didn't want to do Prosecco, cheddar is often really good with an IPA, and I would go right to New Glarus Brewing probably for their Imperial IPA and get a six-pack of that. I think that could be a really great complement.
Now, some people don't care for aged cheese because the taste is so strong. What do you think aged cheese has going for it? How would you sell someone on the idea of a really aged cheese?
Well, you're tasting 20 years of time. I mean, that's incredible. It's like geologic, practically. And so I would say, you know, imagine what you were doing 20 years ago. Now you could taste that period of time. Of course you would expect it to be rich and robust. And again, you might just be having a taste of this cheese, just a little crumb. It's like caviar. So the idea isn't to eat a lot of it or have a smorgasbord, but just to have one sample and to really enjoy the long-lasting flavors. And if you're someone who likes milder things, you know, that's fine. But this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, so why not step up?
Now, if we're honest with ourselves, most of us will probably not be able to eat this particular cheese, for one thing, the cost, for another, the availability. But let's say you do want to put together a really beautiful cheese board to celebrate for some other occasion, maybe not with this 20-year cheddar, but with some other special cheese. What do you suggest for putting together a beautiful cheese board?
There's different approaches. You could, I always love to do like a three milks cheese board where you're having goat, cow, and sheep. They all have different levels of kind of lushness, and so it's nice to start with the goat. It's friendly. It's usually fairly on the mellow side, and it can be a nice entryway to then having something that's a little more lush or a little more fatty, like a cow's milk cheese. And then finishing off with some sheep's milk at the end, where you just get this deep, rich character. So that can be a fun way to go. You could also do a regional cheese board. There's so many incredible Wisconsin cheeses. Or you could pick a country, a Northern Italian cheese board, a Spanish cheese. Cheese Board, and it can be a little way to learn something about an agricultural region that is maybe a place that you've traveled or a place you would like to travel. For example, wherever I go, I'm always looking in the cheese atlas to figure out, okay, what cheeses would be local to that area, and then before I visit, if I can have a taste, it's like it already brings you forward. So those are just a few things that I like to do, but honestly, I love to go to a great cheese counter and start a cheese board by asking the person behind the counter, the cheesemonger, what did you take home last night?
I love
whatever
the word.
They took home last night is what I want to take home tonight. I know it's going to be the ripest thing probably at the counter. It might be something really new and different that the employees are trying. Or that employee is probably really educated on what's good and so is going to take on something wonderful. So I find it's easy to get in a rut with cheese and always get the same thing. But if you develop a relationship with the cheesemonger and simply put it in their hands, that can be a really fun way to learn about new cheeses.
Well, Zaniah, thanks for all the great advice. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Tania Darlington, food writer and cheese expert. She blogs under the name Madame Fromage. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. A new report out today comes to the conclusion that echoes what one Wisconsin congressman had previously proposed, eliminating the United States Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, also known as the ATF.
The authors of the new report and Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner say the Bureau has lost the ability to do its job thanks to some high-profile operation failures and internal dysfunction, among other factors. So how did the ATF get to this point, and if eliminated, what would that mean for gun laws and regulations in America?
Here with us now to talk about the troubled history of the ATF as well as its proposed elimination is John Diedrich. He's a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who's been covering the Bureau's missteps in Milwaukee. John, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to join you.
So we're hearing this new call, this report saying get rid of the ATF. So what would happen if this report were accepted and taken as is?
Well, the recommendations of the report, this is from the Center for American Progress, a left think tank. When I say left, they come, the individuals in the think tank come out of groups such as Mayors Against Illegal Guns, Brady Center, other organizations like that that have been talking about gun control for a while, as well as the Obama administration. It's interesting because, again, we're seeing these calls from different sides of the political spectrum, but this report, 182-page report released today, details how the functions of the ATF should be, in their view, folded into the FBI. The argument of the report is essentially that the United States already has the premier law enforcement agency in the world, in the FBI. The FBI already does background checks, and that information then is passed on to the ATF, and it already does a lot of criminal investigation very well. It has strong oversight and leadership on control of operations, and therefore the nation's gun laws should be enforced through the FBI and not a standalone agency, as it has for decades through the ATF.
Now, you mentioned this comes from the Center for American Progress, left of center, and Republican Congressman from Wisconsin, Jim Sensenbrenner, has made a similar case to get rid of the ATF. Are they coming at this for mostly the same reasons or from completely different reasons?
Well, I think there are some similarities. You referenced some of the operational failures of the ATF recently. Most spectacularly has been the Operation Fast and Furious. That was where agents observed as a couple thousand high-power weapons passed in the hands of criminals and ended up at crime scenes in Mexico, many of those weapons, including the scene where a U.S. border agent was killed. That operation and the aftermath of that has led to a lot of fallout for the agency, a lot of investigation and so forth. Here in Milwaukee, we had storefront operations where agents lost control of guns, employed a mentally disabled individual where the operation was burglarized, and we found problems with in storefronts across the country. So the agency has had these problems, and both the center and Representative Sensenbrenner has raised those operational problems as really saying, you know, this shows an agency that doesn't have good control of its operations and good accountability for those who are responsible for implementing those. So they agree on that. They also talk about the lack of sort of losing their way on the inside, if you will. And there's a GAO report that came out earlier this year that also raised some similar questions and some similar points about the internal structure of the ATF. What's interesting in this report, in contrast with the Representative Sensenbrenner's proposal, and it is a proposal that he made in a bill last year and he's brought back this year as well, is the Center for American Progress really wants a stronger enforcement of the nation's gun laws. And their argument is essentially you've got a damaged vehicle, a hobbled, and hapless at times and toothless at times agency that's not able to enforce the nation's gun laws, and gun violence is a growing issue that they think could be better handled by the FBI. Representative Sensenbrenner, who, by the way, has very strong endorsement of the NRA, not on this particular issue, but in general, strong supporter in the gun rights circle, essentially says this is a way we can save money, and but we don't need to change any of the gun laws. And there are some similar differences among the similarities. There are many, but there are differences in how what restrictions there would be, say on use of trace data and so forth, and how publicly those would become available. That's where the similarities depart, and the two proposals separate a little bit. So they come at it, to answer your question, they come at it from the same direction and common ground at some points, and others they differ.
Talking to John Diedrich with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a call in a report today to get rid of the ATF, roll its duties, most of them, into the FBI. And John, you just mentioned the National Rifle Association. Gun rights groups in the past have been opposed to getting rid of the ATF. How much sway have they had on this issue, and why are they opposed to getting rid of it?
Well, I think there's various points of view that they've raised. And this isn't, I just back up a little bit in terms of the history. This is not the first time that it's been proposed that ATF be melded into other agencies. The calls began in the Carter administration, came up in the Reagan administration, came up in the Clinton administration, and it's come up from various groups as well. So this is not brand new, though. The way this report lays it out, there is new material, and it goes deeper than we've seen in the past. When the Ronald Reagan ran for office, one of the promises that he made was to abolish the ATF, and that came fairly close to happening. And in the sort of 11th hour, the NRA weighed in and said that was not a good idea. And the reasons why have never been publicly stated. The authors of this report, their argument is that essentially the NRA and other groups benefit from a weakened agency such as the ATF, and they don't want to take on an agency like the FBI, which has much better sort of reputation on the Hill, a cachet that the ATF has never had, and a director that has a 10-year term. And while the ATF has had great difficulty getting even a director confirmed for one term, and he left after 18 months, the FBI has a 10-year term. So the sense was this is a bear that the NRA doesn't want to have to deal with. But talking to the NRA for this story, their point is that that moving the ATF doesn't make sense, that they see the real problem in how the Bureau and its policies are implemented, and that they paint the president as an anti-Second Amendment president that is advancing his agenda through the ATF. And noted, and they have in the past, that there was an ammunition ban that was proposed, ultimately rescinded. It was a sort of a PR mess, kind of got ahead of themselves before they had any real support lined up. They point to that as an example of the White House using the ATF to advance their agenda. So their argument is it doesn't matter where the ATF is, the real change has to happen in the White House. I would point out that, interestingly, when Sensenbrenner, Representative Sensenbrenner's proposal came out, both gun rights groups and gun control groups came out against it. So you'd think these would be groups that wouldn't agree on much. And but this was something that they agreed on, is that they, for somewhat different reasons, there was a gun rights group that also said we need to give the new director, that was B. Todd Jones, a chance to implement his changes. And that was the refrain from the gun control groups as well, to say that the new director needs some time. But it was interesting sort of politically that the notion of getting rid of the ATF was actually was something that these groups that don't agree on much did agree on.
Let's look at the mission of the ATF in reading this report and your reporting on it. I guess it started as a taxing agency collecting revenue from alcohol and other products. Now it's a regulatory agency. It's a law enforcement agency. It's a mixed mission in some ways. Is that part of the problem?
Well, that's the argument of the report, and this has been the argument of, there was another agency known as the Commission on the Advancement of Federal Law Enforcement that made the same point. So this goes back. This is a Civil War era taxing entity that really morphed into a sort of law enforcement agency while retaining its taxing and regulatory responsibilities. It picked up the law enforcement side of it when the Gun Control Act came in, but they've always had this taxing piece. And so that's why at one time they were actually in the Treasury Department, and they came over to the Justice Department after the attacks of 9/11. But they've always had this sort of disparate nature. So you have on one side of it the regulatory responsibilities, and primarily the part that's covered mostly in this report is their responsibility to go out and inspect gun stores, federal firearms licensees, and they've taken a lot of heat for their inability to get to many dealers, and when they do, their failure to act when they have some problematic gun dealers. And so, for instance, here in Milwaukee, we had Badger Guns, and became Badger Outdoors, and then back to Badger Guns. This was an operation that had problems over the years, violations and so forth, and they were able to basically defeat ATF's authority by changing ownership and so forth. Part of that was because of the way the law has been structured and the limitations that Congress put on it. And it's also also ATF unwilling to really take on the tough fight of these gun dealers. So that piece has continued. And then on the other side is this law enforcement piece. And really, in that way, they're the primary agency for enforcing the gun laws of the country in terms of, like, gangs and things of that nature. The problem with that side, as this report notes and Representative Sensenbrenner notes, is that clearly overlaps with several other agencies. So, for instance, the storefront that was done here in Milwaukee was an effort to get illegal guns off the street, but it has much to do with drug sales and making drug sales. Well, that's usually would be more of a DEA Drug Enforcement Administration function, or a local police function. So, that's where this sort of sense of looking for a mission and finding, finding a piece of pie for themselves leaves them, sometimes taking chances on operations that are ill-advised and have not turned out well for them in the end.
We're talking with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter John Diedrich about a new report out today from the Center for American Progress calling for the elimination of the United States Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, Explosives. We want to hear your thoughts on the idea.
Do you think the ATF's ability to do its job has been compromised? Should it be eliminated or possibly reformed? And if it is eliminated, what do you think that would mean for gun regulations in America?
We're talking about the United States Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF. New report from a left-of-center group suggests eliminating the Bureau. It echoes a call from Wisconsin Republican Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, who proposed doing just that last year and again this year. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is it time to get rid of the ATF, roll it, most of its functions, into the FBI, or does it serve a valuable function, deserves resources? What questions do you have about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Oh, we'll go to our callers now. We've got Brent on the line in Duluth, Minnesota. Brent, hi.
Yeah, hi, guys. I'm kind of in the gun business, you might say. I make custom muzzle-loading guns. In fact, I'm working on one right now. If they do decide to eliminate the ATF, or BATFE as it's called, they better come up with something that's more effective. Most gun people would tell you that the ATF is like jackbooted thugs and they're out to destroy America and all this, and that's just a bunch of crap. Really, we need better gun laws, stronger gun laws, and somebody that could enforce them. Yeah, enforce the laws we have, but also plug the existing loopholes.
Gotcha, Brent. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll throw that to John Diedrich, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel now. John, a gun person, a particular sort of guns there, saying this agency is ineffective as it stands.
Yeah, it's this is a lot of the comments that you'll hear is from folks who've been critical of the ATF and saying, we don't need additional laws. We need to enforce the laws that we have. It's complicated because once you start getting into how the laws are implemented, there's also a series of limits on what the ATF can do. They're known as budget riders, and these have limited some would say the effectiveness, just the ability for ATF to do certain things. For instance, the sharing of trace data when gun crimes and so forth are crime guns are traced, that information cannot be widely shared. So there's limits on what they do. There is also a limit to the enforcement of things like gun show operations, guns sold over the internet, and so forth. And the report raises this to say, here are the marketplaces where illegal guns are being trafficked at times, and because, again, not because of the lack of laws, but because the ATF is so damaged and has come under fire so many times from Congress that the leadership there is just really unwilling to do it, do those kind of operations. But it really goes deeper than that, even, because you have an agency, and they point this out in there, and that you have essentially the ATF is they're broken up into about two dozen field divisions, 25 across the country, and they really act as separate fiefdoms, where the special agent in charge in those areas has tremendous power, and Washington doesn't have as much control as you might think over those places and what happens in there. And so, while the discussion about the laws and so forth, really important, what the report raises, what Representative Sensenbrenner raises, is that whether you have new laws or the existing laws, you have an organization where morale is very low, where control from Washington is limited, it appears to be at best by what we've seen, and you have some real deep personnel problems. So whatever the laws are, the argument from this report is that this agency is really hard pressed to get their act together.
Brent, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. As we talk about proposals to get rid of the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, we've got John Diedrich with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Back to our callers now. We've got Hank on the line in Cuba City. Hank, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think, Hank?
I'm thinking, I don't know if the agency needs to be completely eliminated because there's so many new levels of brew pub and now the micro distilleries and things like that coming out. The agency still has a place, I believe, whether it's under that portion should be under the FDA for tobacco and alcohol, and then the other half should be with the FBI. It just seems like a no-brainer.
Hank, thanks for that call. And that's interesting, John. We've focused, and a lot of the discussion is focused on the firearm part of things. If we get rid of the ATF, what happens to the alcohol and tobacco portion of their job?
Well, the taxing portion of that is held elsewhere. But the question is, should they be, because they've also been involved in some enforcements involving tobacco and alcohol cases. The question's been raised, is that their best use of resources? Those essentially are tax cases, are individuals paying taxes on tobacco or alcohol and so forth. And it's been again, sort of an odd combination of alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and then you threw explosives in there later. Again, sort of an odd pairing that you would have those things together. And I think Hank raises an interesting point in that, do these really all go together? And what's interesting is that there isn't, in Representative Sensenbrenner's argument, he's just saying, basically these things can be broken up in different places as well. But that the heartland of this thing is whether you need another federal law enforcement agency to essentially act as a, as a quasi federal police department. And you do raise these up. Well, you could always go off and do tobacco or do alcohol. Well, or are those really things that are best in a Treasury Department where taxes and so forth be assessed at that point and have the investigative power of that agency be able to look at those tax cases and so forth. Again, sort of, and the report talks about this, sort of a Frankenstein nature of this organization, that it's really been, all these different parts sort of ad hoc have been added on over the years, and it's just led to sort of this curious agency that just has a lot of different pieces in a lot of different ways that don't necessarily connect to each other.
Now, the ATF over the years has gotten a lot of criticism from the Branch Davidian standoff near Waco, Texas, so their involvement in a standoff in Ruby Ridge, all the way up through, as you mentioned, Fast and Furious and this new backfire operation, efforts to close it over the decades. Is there any indication that this is getting traction this time around, that it might actually go somewhere this time, John?
Well, it's an interesting point. The old sort of saying is that, bureaucracy doesn't go away. Though you have a Republican Congress. Now, you need just more than a majority. You need more than that. But you have a Democratic White House, and this organization, you have a second-term president who can do some things and not worry about re-election. The center, it has some close links into the Obama White House, and there was a report by a gun rights and conservative blogger a few years ago about a white paper that was produced. Now, this white paper has never been released publicly, but that it was floated by the White House that suggested this possibility. This was in the midst of Fast and Furious. This document's never been released, but what this raised was that this possibility of a more broad coalition around this concept, for various reasons, may be taking hold. The last individual before Representative Sensenbrenner to propose abolishing the ATF was Representative Conyers, from a Democrat from Michigan. Now, he proposed that after the Branch Davidian Waco incident, and that was out of a real frustration at the time. Now, there was a lot of it essentially never went anywhere, but there is a sense that now, again, there could be more traction. Jason Chaffetz, Representative Chaffetz, who's head of the Oversight Committee, a Republican from Utah, has voiced initial support. Senator Durbin from Illinois floated this idea. So you're seeing on both sides. What will be interesting to see is ultimately the interest groups, and particularly the NRA, if they would change on this.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter John Diedrich. He joined us to talk about a new report out today calling for the elimination of the United States Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.